Hi, this is Tamson Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
And we're here on May 14th, 2014. 2017. My, yes. How time flies. For Dan and Tamson.
Read the paper. Or Tamson and Dan read the paper. Either one of those.
All right.
We're going to start today with really a wonderful musical play we saw just last week. It was an Encores production of a play that was presented in 1954 called The Golden Apple, and it's a musical retelling of a sort of the Iliad and the Odyssey.
The Iliad and the Odyssey, and it's based on the Trojan War, which of course happens because of the Judgment of Paris. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, yes. I'm all over it.
Well, you sound like you aren't. So yeah. Let me refresh your memory, because it's a pretty good story.
Yes.
It starts with a wedding, actually, oddly enough.
Right.
Wedding of Peleus and Thetis.
Mm-hmm.
And when they make up the guest list.
Right.
And, Peleus, mortal, Thetis, sea nymph. It's a mixed marriage.
Right.
So I don't know if that's part of the problem. I don't know. So I don't know if they're trying to keep it on the down low or they're, constrained in terms of numbers. But they leave out one goddess.
Yeah.
The goddess of strife.
Leave out. Don't
She's off the list. She's not invited.
Okay.
And you can see that.
Right.
Why invite the goddess of strife into your...
I'm going to find out why in just a second.
Of course, goddess of strife, comes the wedding, comes the reception, etc. Goddess of strife has to cause some strife.
Right.
And so into the party, she tosses a golden apple.
Right.
Okay, get it? Golden apple.
Right.
That is inscribed with a word that basically means for the fairest. So immediately... this is Diva Central.
Right.
Party with all these goddesses, all the goddesses fighting over it. And it comes down to the big three. Hera, Mrs. Zeus.
Yeah.
Athena,
mm-hmm.
daughter of Zeus.
Yeah.
And Aphrodite, also known as Venus, goddess of love.
Right.
Okay. Who, maybe she's his aunt, maybe she's his daughter, it's not really clear.
Okay.
So they're all going, Zeus, pick one of us. Which one of us is the fairest? Zeus, no fool.
Right.
Zeus says, I can't decide. He's there with his wife.
Right.
He can only lose.
Right.
Wife, aunt, daughter, whatever. So he says, look, how about this guy Paris? He'll be an objective judge of this. We'll get him to do it. Paris is a young guy. I don't know. He's out on Mount Ida. I don't know, watching the sheep or something.
Right.
Not clear how Zeus really chooses him. He's like 18. And so the goddesses say, okay, all right, we can do that. And they immediately run over to him and start taking off their clothes. Mm-hmm. Whoa, 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 whoa. He can't make up his mind based on that, apparently. And so they begin to make him promises. Hera promises him, supreme, political power. He's going to rule the world to the extent he can. Then Athena promises, Athena, goddess of wisdom and war. And she promises him great skill in battle.
Right.
And Aphrodite, Venus, promises him supreme sexual ecstasy.
Mm-hmm.
Did I say he's 18?
Yeah, he's 18. That's
cool. So he chooses... Aphrodite.
I got it. Yeah.
And the key to sexual ecstasy, apparently, during this period, is Helen, wife of Menelaus.
Right.
And so, she is already married. When her father promised her to Menelaus, and there were all these, everybody wanted to marry her, everybody, including Odysseus. And her father makes all the suitors promise that no matter whom he chooses, they will support that guy no matter what happens.
Yeah.
If there's ever any threat to Helen, they will support him. So Paris and Helen run off to Troy, and Menelaus and all the other suitors, all the other Greek kings, princes, whatever, head off to kind of save the day, get her back.
Mm-hmm.
And there you have the Trojan War.
That's interesting, because I, at the beginning I had no idea what you were talking about, which is not an unusual experience here, but as you went on, I began to sense that that had parallels with what I actually saw in the play.
In the play, they make it into a bake-off, like a Pillsbury bake-off.
Exactly, exactly.
And the minced meat pie wins, right. Which right. Doesn't really resonate in this day and age.
Yeah, well, here's what's interesting to me about this, is that they're about to do this musical retelling of this classic, and they're confronted with exactly what you described, which is how they're going to make that work in a musical. And the answer is... not without tremendous difficulty. So they do the best they can. They do a reasonable job. But the fact of the matter is, that's not what made the evening memorable. Right. What made the evening memorable was the music was great. This is one of those situations where the Times and I happen to be seeing eye to eye. They say that there are ingredients here of camp Americana operetta, and it could have been that. But oh, the music, 135 glorious minutes of it. Morose, that's the composer, best known for his film scores, was a member of Aaron Copland's coterie and brings the familiar sound we call American with its modal harmonies and widely spaced voicings to a work of astonishing breadth and beauty. And I think that's right. I mean, they talk about Aaron Copland again and again and the people who write about this. And, of course, the Aaron Copland Western score that's famous is the Rodeo Suite. And, of course, you have the hoedown bit of it, which is the slogan, the musical slogan for Beef What's for Dinner. You'll recall that one. And it's in the American
vocabulary. You're trying to bring this down to my level.
Yeah, thank you. It's fantastic soaring music, and it's sort of borderline opera. And there's a style at that time in the 50s. You have this. You have the Golden Apple. You have the Most Happy Fella, which also has no dialogue, just singing. And of course, you have Candide by Bernstein.
Is that true that Most Happy Fellow has dialogue?
No dialogue. No
Are you
dialogue.
Kidding me?
Take my word, Frank Lesser. No dialogue. And that's a style that was in vogue in a short time in the 50s. It's music bordering on opera. And this thing, in my mind, just soared. But having said that, that's the way Encores works. It's just a weekend set of performances. Last performance this evening. Sorry. All we can do is tell you to keep an eye on for Encores in the future.
But this is exactly what you look to Encores for.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, something that everybody's forgotten, but it's a hidden gem.
Hidden? But I had never heard of this.
Right.
And this knocked my socks off.
Knock my socks off.
I got that.
Okay.
That's good, because you were saying yourself...
I think Most Happy Fellow, much more accessible music than...
There's no question.
This is good music. The voices are beautiful.
You know something? Just to round that out, and arguably Candide, slightly superior music, Leonard Bernstein.
But, I love Candide.
Okay, but this is right up there, I mean, in my mind. All right, so anyway, we had a great evening at the theater. Let's move on to more mundane subjects. We noticed this week that there's a new comic book character in town.
And you noticed. I didn't notice.
I noticed it. And it is in a comic strip called, a comic book called The Adventures of the American Toman. He's a character that tows. As in tow truck. The Wall Street Journal had this. It's not like I'm sort of trolling for comic book characters. It was featured in the Wall Street Journal.
It's easy to imagine you doing that.
It is easy, but it didn't happen. Adventures of the American Towman, in which a heroic driver rescues people in peril. And it comes from a media empire that churns out towing magazines, ballads, and even a TV show called Got a Bump, Call Lump. And there's a whole, empire here with very compelling graphics with this new superhero. So it sort of brings up the question, which was happily anticipated by the New York Times, what does it take to make your own superhero? And by perhaps coincidence, perhaps not, in this very Sunday's newspaper, there is an article called How to Create Your Own Superhero. Excuse me. So get a pencil, because there are four or five precise pointers here. This is the way
how you do it.
Here's how you do it. First, do's and don'ts, by the way. Do come up with a really cool name and a really cool costume.
Well, I think they blew that with the...
American Towman. I don't know. Well, the article in the Times just came out, so they didn't have the benefit of it. Look, we're moving
beyond.
I'll
have to go back and read that.
You know, there are other places to go. Two. Don't get too complicated. Always good advice.
Right.
Comic books. Number three, do make sure your character is interesting in the costume and outside it. Okay? You know? don't take that literally. My point is, in real life, you know, in a secret identity. I should point out that these
tips... I think this is all problematic for the tow truck.
These are tips that are provided by the editor-in-chief.
Super Tow Man.
Editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics has provided these. So these are the real deal, the real tips.
And what's the next?
Just a couple more. Next, don't make your superhero too super. Now, this is a mistake made all the time by DC Comics. Don't make them so they're not scared of anything. That gets dull. There's no drama. Make sure they have flaws and weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's another Toman problem there, okay? Just a couple more. Do give your superhero interesting friends and enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And I think...
Is the title of this article How to Create Your Own Superhero? Is it, or is it How to Create Your Own Greek God?
I was just thinking there are parallels here.
Yes.
And then the last tip is... this fits right into the Greek gods. Do create problems that challenge your hero, both physically and emotionally.
Hope
you wrote all those down so you can get started starting your own superhero. But
speaking of superheroes.
Yes, if you can't name your own superhero, you can name your own child. And there was an interesting article about children's
names. Dad was sobered this weekend when we picked up the Wall Street Journal to see a headline that said, "New parents don't like Mike." And underneath it said, "U.S. boys named Michael dip to 76-year low."
That's right.
And this is just sad because...
Because I have a brother named Michael.
Yeah.
And talk about bad news.
The number one spot on the federal list of top baby names for 43 out of 44 years.
Was Michael.
Okay, the longest boy's reign of the 20th century.
But that's over. Those days are over.
In case you're wondering what the top names are now, they are Noah, Liam, William, Mason for boys.
Noah is
Emma,
number one.
Olivia, Ava, Sophia, Isabella.
Right.
So for girls.
So 6 years from now in a kindergarten class, some young teacher is going to look up and say, "Noah, could you stand up and recite to the class?" And the whole class, all the boys are going to stand up.
And few names, apparently, rival Michael's historic dominance.
Right. Well, that actually was the point.
The Generation X juggernaut, Jennifer, held number one from 1970 to 84.
Right.
Okay, but it's down to number 273
right.
at this
well,
point.
Look, they vacillate.
But anyway, one of the things that's fun about this article is that it mentions this fellow, Michael Shackelford, who was an actuary, actually, and was...
an actuary?
Yeah, he worked as a Social Security Administration actuary.
It's a little bit of a dope for an actuary, but yes.
Well, anyway, okay, so he's used to pulling together big data, or whatever we like to call it. And when his wife became pregnant... He did not want his kid to have a name like his, Michael.
Right.
It was so, they're always,
He wanted an uncommon name. Yeah. So where did he go to get the uncommon name?
So he started doing this research, started compiling these things. And so armed with all this data, he actually, when it comes time to call to name his child, he names his child Aiden.
Aiden. And here's the kicker. Where did he get the name?
From the TV show Sex and the City.
Right. So his bright idea.
One of his favorite characters.
His bright idea is in order to get an unusual name.
Like there are
no one else will match.
In the world.
He picks a character from Sex
right,
and the City.
That name.
Genius.
And so, of course, as his son Aiden goes through life, he actually comes into contact with a lot of other Aidens.
Yes. So. That's rough. He's going to have a tough time.
But anyway, Michael is not the deal anymore. And it turns out, actually, also, the other interesting thing is, how do you say this? No name is as dominant.
That's right. Michael was at his heyday, Michael was 4%, accounted for 4% of the names in the general population. Now, Noah, whatever
now
is the most popular name
is like 0.7.
Right. And so, the point there being that the new generation of folks having babies are that much more intent on making sure that their child has a unique name. And we're sympathetic to that. We have children with unique names, namely Granger, Sadie, and Zeke. We get that. But on the other hand, we didn't look for our names in Sex and the City. So We had a little bit of an edge there. So things have changed. You know what an unusual name will be in the future, Tozen?
What?
Michael. So you might want to come back to that one because that one's off the list.
These things do ebb and flow.
That's right.
All right.
Okay, so we've had several articles and a similar theme about how the brain works this week.
Yes, strangely. And we're quite interested in that.
We are.
We want to figure it out before it's too late.
Before it's too late. Well, there are some tips on that, too. There was an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal, an interview with a woman named Barbara Oakley, who is an engineering professor at Detroit's Oakland University, but perhaps better known because she provides, I don't know what the right word is, she offers the most well-known, I'm going to say MOOC, in the nation, but Tamsin knows this acronym better than I'm. MOOC, which stands for, it's an open course you can get on the internet, basically, right? Mm-hmm. And it's the most popular in the country, mm-hmm. and it's about learning. And how is it that she came to know so much about learning? And she came to know so much about learning because she had trouble learning. She had trouble learning math when she was a kid. And she ends up
an engineer?
Yeah, she did. Yeah. She ended up specializing in languages and was even working for the government because she had mastered in Russian. But she was nowhere with respect to math or science, but she found out all the folks that she worked with who were moving along career-wise were engineers, were mm-hmm. technical people, mm-hmm. be they Russian or be they American. Mm-hmm. And she decided, she had a very varied career, but she would just start with basic math and work her way up. And she worked her way up to advanced math. And she ended up also appreciating how her own mind works and how mind works generally, and got together with several people in terms of specialists in terms of the way neurons work and how it works. And she came up with several interesting points here. I'll just mention one or two. One is she said that the thing that she feels where American education lets folks down a little bit is, unlike old-fashioned education, modern education doesn't have enough repetition, that she felt that there's an emphasis on understanding. But she felt there is no substitute for employing the whatever the regime is again and again and again, because it develops a sort of an intellectual dexterity that there's no substitute
for. It's like a muscle memory.
Boom. Exactly, muscle memory. And she said she found that European education actually seems to appreciate this and take advantage of it.
Yeah.
But American education not. And that helped her quite a bit, even though it's so terribly old-fashioned.
Yeah.
The other thing, though, that she does credit American education with is that there's an appreciation that that there's such a thing called neural resting states. In other words, when you come up with a problem that you can't quite solve, it's wise to leave it alone.
Mm-hmm.
And, I've experienced this. I think you have too, Tamsin. Yeah. You walk away from it. The mind's working it through. There is a subconscious process that works on solving things. And so you have this resting exercise and you have this more intentional drilling exercise. They both become part of the learning process in what she sees as optimal learning. Anyway, so it's quite an interesting process. It's clearly worked for her. And she does, you'll be happy to know, the article ends with a few tips for folks who are getting older and figure out how to keep themselves mentally sharp. And of course, the number one thing is exercise, which it always is in these articles.
Okay.
Reading, learning a language, and of course, we'll all be happy to hear this, playing video games. There's no substitute for playing video games to keep you sharp and to enable you to keep your eyesight up so you can read the small print on those medicine bottles. So she advocates that.
All right, I'll have to work on the video game part, I guess.
Yes, I guess so.
Which, right in line with that, there was also an article in the Wall Street Journal about toddler play
mm-hmm.
and learning.
Right.
And apparently there was a study done at Berkeley
mm-hmm.
that they compared teaching toddlers how to use a variety of machines that play music. And each machine is activated a different way by a particular colored block or particular shaped block.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had two groups of kids and they compared kids. They tested kids. One group had actually been taught and, the whole mechanism had been explained to them and they were, coached through it, et cetera. And then they were tested. In the other group, the leader, the adult, shows one machine and demonstrates that it, you know, if you use this block, it will play music, but doesn't explain, doesn't go through the different colors or different machines or different shapes, doesn't go through any of that, just does that one and this, oh, I have to leave the room for a few minutes. You can play with my toys. Mm-hmm. And leaves the room for 5 minutes, and the kids, you know, do play with the machines and sort out on their own how they work. And then when they tested the two groups against each other, the kids that taught themselves through play did as well as the kids who were taught how to use them. So that was kind of interesting. And, you know, it's all those little inspirational things you hear about play is the work of childhood, etc. Turns out it
something to
looks,
it.
Yeah, yeah, like it might actually may be true.
Well, and there's something also about, in particular, how men's minds work. And this may surprise some, but perhaps not everybody. And it's called, an article in the journal called The Golfer's Delusion. And the delusion, of course.
That could be a long article. It seems to me there are many
I'm going to summarize it. I'm going to give a brief synopsis. Mm. And the delusion is that men think they're better golfers than they are. In particular, they think they're bigger hitters than
really?
They are.
Really? Men think they're better golfers than
I don't know.
They
maybe
are?
It was a skewed sample. But what they found, and this is a...
I'm shocked.
One of the things that perplexes people who make golfing equipment is that men use the wrong golf club. In other words, you're given, as you well know, when you play golf, you have to decide which iron to use. I'm going to use a 5-iron or a 7-iron. One's more likely to go farther, one less far, get a little more height. So you have a decision to make, a strategic decision to make. But men get it wrong. They always use the wrong club. And the reason they use the wrong club is they overestimate their ability to hit the ball. Or put another way, statistically, they find that men are 4 times as likely to pick a club that causes them to be short of the green, then they'll pick a club that causes them to overshoot the green. It's a psychological problem. And the reason is, they figured out, that when asked how far they're likely to hit the ball, they remember and visualize their most successful shot. They said, I once hit a 5-iron, you know, 195 yards. But they, without thinking, but that was once. You don't generally do it.
But when you think about it, I mean, maybe it's not so good for your golf game.
Right.
But I think it's a good way to go through life.
It is a good way to go through life.
Yeah,
there's no question. Yeah. It is a good way to go through life. So there are pluses and there are minuses. And it could be that these folks are well served by that kind of, you know, self-regard in a lot of endeavors. But when it comes to golf, they're not reaching the green. So somehow the golf club people have got to get the message out there. And when they do it, it's going to improve everyone's golf game.
So you're right. I don't think it's terribly surprising, is it?
No. Not a shot. All right. So you said you saw something about a newly recognized classic, or it's a book that you and I are both quite familiar with, which is Lost Horizon, if I recall.
Well, actually, there was an article. There's a column in the Wall Street Journal called Masterpieces.
Oh, really? Okay.
And the book... brought up this week is Lost Horizons. Yeah. And the author of the article is ranking it up there with Great Gatsby and Lolita.
Oh, that's something.
And
I mean,
it's written by James Hilton
right.
in 1933. And basically, what would you say the story is?
It's a story about a utopian society in the Himalayas. Right.
Right. There's a hijacking of a plane.
Oh yeah.
If you can believe it, 1933.
Right.
And they crash and end up in this Shangri-La.
Right. And this is a remote area. They're hiking in the snow. It looks like they're not going to survive. And they come into this little valley. And there are all these folks with these beatific expressions.
And this sort of perfect little closed society.
And the kicker is, and I don't think we're giving away too much, is this the premise? No one ages. In the society. So what you have is a bunch of folks who look in the prime of life, and when they're asked how old they are, they all say, well, I'm 400 years old, which is why it's a novel. But we're not talking so much the novel, of course, we're talking about the movie.
Yeah.
So James Hilton wrote 3 books, which all became relatively big movies. So
right, he wrote and they're also good books. I mean, they're short novels,
right.
And they're not real intellectually challenging.
Right.
But I love all of them.
Right.
I love Lost Horizon, Goodbye, Mr. Chips, Random Harvest.
Random Harvest
just
was
really
great.
Tickled my fancy.
Right. And
these are all movies you can see like a million different ways, including YouTube, easily seen for free.
In particular, Lost. I would look up Lost Horizon or Random Harvest. I mean, and
Ronald Coleman.
The star of both is Ronald Coleman. It's worth mentioning. I mean, talk about completely forgotten. But you know, there are cartoon characters in the 50s and 60s who were really imitations of Ronald Coleman. He was this very proper English expression, devastating, good-looking guy. Great hero. And sort of, if you I don't know how to put it exactly, a sophisticated Clark Gable, if you will. It's just great stuff. It's a great movie, Lost Horizon. We really recommend it.
And also, the book itself was one of the first like little paperback so-called pocketbooks.
That's right. And it has a sufficiently almost lurid cover. But it's enough to bring you into it.
So either way you go, you can't lose.
Yes, that's true. So we recommend Lost Horizon. And we also saw a movie this week, which we recommend.
An odd movie.
And that's Norman, The Moderate Rise and Tragic Fall of a New York Fixer. And it is
starring
Richard Gere. And it's an interesting story. I don't want to give away too much of the story, but Richard Gere plays a character in New York who is a guy who's just trying to arrange deals, but he's an outsider. He's just trying to get his way inside. And he does that by sort of overspeaking his relationship with various folks, trying to put together deals and getting his 7%. And he's always reaching out, and he's annoying, honestly.
He's terribly annoying. So this movie kind of follows him through making these connections.
And it is...
tough to get into the movie.
And it is unbelievable to believe you're watching Richard Gere. Because Richard Gere
He seems pretty schlubby in this movie.
I will tell you the trick in a minute. There's a trick to this, all right? Richard Gere is the epitome of self-assurance in almost every movie. He's a very good-looking man, and he's total confidence. Here, he's reaching. He's not quite comfortable. He doesn't look great, although it's clearly Richard Gere. It's kind of tricky. And I read an article which sort of gives you a suggestion of how they did that. And the answer is the ears. They did something to his ears which throws his face off about 5%.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And you have to stare. Because they said to themselves,
does that mean we
can't do an obvious prosthetic. It's got to be Richard Gere. But that's why it looks different. He's got a bad haircut. And the ears are a little different.
So if you got a better haircut and had a little surgery on the ears,
I would look even more like Richard Gere.
All right.
Of course, you know. but in any event, that's a different subject. The point is, it's Tamsin got it exactly right. You got to stay with it. It's like an Isaac Bashevis Singer story. It's almost a fable. And we could talk about it quite a bit because there are many interesting aspects of it. But you have to see it. And it's not for everybody, possibly.
I did sit there thinking, why did I let him drag me to this? And in the end, I was completely caught up in it.
There you go. Yeah. And it builds and it says a lot about the character and about mankind, actually, about humankind and the way they relate. And it comes to a satisfying conclusion. So we recommend Norman.
6 degrees of separation.
Namely what?
My shop. Cranberry Food Sampler, back in the day.
Oh, yes, I know.
Made a wedding cake
for
Richard Gere's sister.
Susan Gere.
No, Joanne.
Oh, no?
Yeah.
Must have been his other sister. Susan. Okay.
And
Susan was the woman. Yeah, okay. Gotcha.
And I actually had to deliver the chef who was working the wedding party and the cake to Princeton.
But you didn't get the
meat. Richard Gere and Cindy Crawford were at the party.
Right.
I didn't see them.
All right.
But I drove right by.
That's close enough for me.
Right.
That's a brush with greatness.
A brush with greatness.
There's no question.
No question.
Okay. So you had something about plants, I think.
Are we on the plants already?
Yes, I think we are.
Fun article. Back to the Wall Street Journal. I'm pretty obsessed with the Wall Street Journal lately.
Yeah.
About plant hydraulics. Yeah. Okay. And good for me because I'm pretty challenged in terms of biology and I do try to grow a lot of plants. And it turns out that a plant is just an engine for turning water and carbon dioxide into oxygen and sugars, a process known as
photosynthesis. I know that.
But even though this mechanism defines a plant, less than 1% of the water sucked up by the roots is used this way.
Right.
The rest of the water is actually forms a slow upward fountain that starts at the roots, flows up inside the stem, and then evaporates through tiny little holes in the leaves.
Right.
And as these little holes on the leaves allow carbon dioxide in and water out.
Yeah, so people are missing the hand motions here.
Okay. The water isn't just flowing passively through this beautiful green structure that happens to contain a photosynthesis factory. The water is actually holding it up.
That's right. See, that's what's interesting to me. That's why after it rains, the plants are standing up.
Right.
Because the water is shooting toward the top.
And when you have not watered your plants,
they droop.
They droop. They wilt. Now, there is a you know, you can't do everything this way. You need a kind of, there's also a sort of woody kind of structure called lignin, natural polymer that, you know, so that that woodiness of, that's why trees don't wilt.
Right. But we're talking about plants. Structure. We're not talking about trees.
Well, but they're still, trees have that hydraulic thing going through their leaves as well.
Fair.
But that's what supports plants. So that I thought was kind of fun.
You also were going to talk about avocado hands, which is a phrase that's new to me.
Yeah. Actually, the New York Magazine this week mentioned that there's, because of, you know, a lot of avocados on the market now. We love avocados.
Right.
We eat guacamole all the time. And there's been a substantial rise in avocado injuries. And at the emergency room, they call it avocado hand. When people are trying to cut open that avocado and...
it's dangerous.
Yes, apparently it's quite dangerous.
It's risky.
And people have severe injuries. You can, like, cut a nerve and, you know, do all kinds of serious damage.
Right.
So there are videos...
of how to on cut
YouTube, you know how to do it properly.
Thank goodness.
So, yeah.
That's right.
So watch out for that avocado hand.
Well, the other thing that's been dominating the news, which I won't go into because it's too close to home, is commuting and the trains and how poor they've been. But there are a couple of coping mechanisms that are of some interest, which have come to light. One of them, which seems to be focused on the area that I grew up in, which is the Miller Ridge Inn.
The Miller Ridge Inn actually gave out free drinks.
Let me just say, before we get to the Miller Ridge Inn, there are some classic photos of me and my brothers in Little League uniforms bearing the name Miller Ridge Inn.
Yes, we still have one of those shirts.
Exactly.
It's quite cute. And,
so there's a strong connection here.
Anyway, they had a LIRR sucks party. And if you came to the Miller Ridge Inn last Thursday showed them your LIRR ticket, you could have a free drink.
Well, that makes it all worth it. The Miller's Inn was a, and probably still is, an extremely classy place. So that's one way to cope. Another way to cope, which I intend to explore, is by developing your own mantra. And the Wall Street
Journal... seems funny that you would explore that. You don't seem like a mantra guy.
I know, but I read it in the newspaper, so it must be true. They say,
you know my mantra.
You know my mantra? Save it. Give it to me at the end, because I want to explain to people how they should choose a mantra, and they can judge your mantra when they hear it.
Okay.
But the reason that mantras work, according to the Wall Street Journal, is this. It's that every thought we have is made up of a complex pattern of activity influenced by gene expressions and neural connections. Right?
It sounds very complicated.
And the more we have a thought, the stronger that circuit grows. Okay? So you can think of any two neurons as friends. The more they communicate, the stronger their connection comes. If you adopt a mantra, then you have this very established connection, and that mantra will be very high in your consciousness and make it easier to deal with things. That's the theory. In other words, when you're in tough times, you don't have to search for a positive thought. The positive thought's available because the neurons that support that mantra are at the ready. And
muscle,
they change your
memory.
Muscle memory, sort of, yes.
Yeah.
So they advocate having a mantra. And here's the advice on how you can come up with your own mantra. Again, get that pencil that you put down with the superhero points. You can pick it back up again and write this down. How you can choose the best mantra, here you do it. First, picture yourself older and wiser. All right? That's always a good start in coming up with a mantra. Then choose several. There might be some that are more suited to one situation than another. Third, keep it short. It has to be easy to remember. And here's the key one. Make sure it's positive, but not unbelievable. If it's too positive, it can feel hokey, right? Mantras have to be based in truth, logic, and helpfulness. Next is trigger your mantra. Practice thinking about what's bothering you and then saying your mantra. And then this one I find a little odd. Picture your new neural pathways. Okay.
I thought it was going to be picture your nude neural pathways.
I know that's what you thought, but you don't. So in other words, that's the advice they have for coming up with a mantra. Now, Tamsin,
that sounds very with this advice in mind, I can't what even is, follow any of that.
I know. What is your mantra?
No, you tell me what is a good mantra. Do they have some examples?
They have some mantras. I didn't think they were so great. You know, it's like I'm a good person and good things happen
this?
To me. I'm telling you that they have some really hokey mantras. Never, never, never give up. Okay, how's that? Here's another one. I'm okay right now. Here's another one. I'm a brick house. I'm mighty, 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 just letting it all hang out.
Well, that is a good song.
Okay. Yeah. Well, they actually do talk about the song here. They credit the Commodores.
That's a terrific song.
Yes.
Yeah.
So those are mantras. But let's go ahead, Tamsin.
My mantra is, in when yam we amount fuck yam.
Oh, of course. That's right. It doesn't mean what you think it means. You better explain what it
is. It's the motto, actually, from my high school, Holton Arms. And it means, I will find a way or make one. And
yes.
I think that's a good
mantra. But is it a mantra or your motto, which is different? Do you really use it as a mantra? You gotta say it a lot.
I do say it. Okay, I don't know. Right. Maybe it's not a mantra.
All right. Well, maybe.
But
it is.
I was looking for a better explanation.
You gotta picture your neurons a little bit more. Okay. Let me we'll close here.
I see the little neurons kind of working together to make solutions.
There they go.
Yeah.
So there is a mantra that comes up in the movie Norman, or more to the point, I read an interview with the director of the movie Norman. Who is a fellow named Joseph Seder, and he's Israeli born, and he lives in Tel Aviv. And I should mention the movie is comprised of actors both from Israel and from the United States.
In fact, in walking around New York, didn't you say?
Well, yeah.
Richard Gere and the Israeli actor.
Well, sometimes we recognize by one group or another. Usually people recognize Richard Gere, but once in a while an Israeli group would go crazy about the Israeli actor.
Much and not
to the puzzlement of both he and Richard Gere.
Yeah.
But in any event, so, in an interview, they asked him, they probed, of course, about the character. And he says, look, there's, a mantra that I've taken or developed from Norman. So, toward the end of the film, someone asks him, why isn't anything ever simple with you? And he says, who says simple is good? Some of the best things that I enjoy in life are extremely complicated. Such as, the question? So it says human needs. Human needs are not so simple. So for this director, at least, his new mantra, who says simple is good.
No, I like that. I like that a lot.
Well, that's a question.
I agree with that.
And that's a question I like to think we ask every week on Tamsin, Dan, Read the Paper.
And we'll be back again next week with Tamsin and Dan, Read the Paper.
Thanks for listening.